My name is Ed Schrader. This is the Wednesday morning Bible study. We're doing the Gospel of Luke, and the title of this session is The Good News According to Luke When It Comes to Abundance of Possessions and the Worry That Goes With It, How to Cope. Let's just start by reading today's text, which is the second of the four segments of Luke 12, which have been put into the lectionary this very year in those churches that use the lectionary. And this was the lesson a week ago Sunday. Next session here, we'll do last Sunday's text, and this is the last session of the week. The fifth one, we'll do the gospel for this coming Sunday. So these are the gospels for these Sundays in late summer. You got your Bible open? You got it open to that? Mm-hmm. Which translation do you have? That looks like old RSV.
Yes.
Don, what do you got?
Good News.
Good News.
Old RSV.
Old RSV.
Old RSV.
Old.
New.
New RSV.
New International.
Okay, so we got four different versions. The rest of you listen to what she says. Look in your own text to see where you see a translation difference. And we'll just try to get a first reading of that. And then fill in the boxes here of this Lucan blueprint that we've developed now in the days we've been here, that Luke diagnoses human's malady in text after text this way, that at the first level, the people live in darkness. Even Christians get conned into that. At a deeper level, underlying that darkness is the fear that's in their own heart, or what I put up there as a negative faith. Fear is trusting something deadly as true for you. The mushroom-shaped cloud, lose my job, lose prestige, cancer, but trusting that that's what's determining my life. Luke's accent that people regularly have their fears misfocused, that there's finally really only one proper object of fear. If you want to fear anybody, you ought to just fear God, because God's the one who really has the total wipeout clause in the contract for you. Nobody else does. Even people who kill you don't have the total wipeout clause going for them. And underlying all of that is this being lost, lost to God. Luke's three lost parables, which only he has in all the Gospels, about lost sheep, lost coin, and what we call the two lost boys. We normally call it the parable of the prodigal son, but it's the parable of both sons. Older brother, who was a so-called good guy, but he was even loster than the kid brother who just went hell-raising out into the world. The good news for Luke, then, we found, is that for the lost folks, Jesus enters the scene as the one who finds the lost or who saves the losers, from which in the heart, joy is Luke's favorite word of Luke, for joy over trumping fear. And going back up then sort of to our life in the public arena, Luke's favorite word is to glorify. People went out and they said, hey, here's what God did to me. Or here's what happened when I bumped into that messianic or that rabbi from Galilee. Incredible things happen. You know, if you hold still, I'll tell you. Since all of you are very profound theologians, I can tell, and not the least of whom Don himself, let me call your attention to one, not gimmick, to one aspect of this paradigm, which has deep, well not deeper, which has significant New Testament roots. Who is the grammatical subject for this material?
The individual.
Yeah, us, people, we. So either first person singular or first person plural, you know, to use grammatical language. So, I am in the dark, or we are in the dark. I am the one with fear, I am the one lost. So on this side, at least all the, you know, it's the x-ray of me, or of us. And so we're the subject being x-rayed, and even the grammatical subject. You can make I connections to all of these predicates. When you move from here to here, when you move from, if you will, from law to gospel, there is a change of subject. The subject changes, because who is obviously the subject over here? You know, not us at all, but this strange Jewish carpenter or the father whom he said sent him. So the subject, the grammatical subject changes. God becomes the actor, and we are then on the receiving end. You know, he finds us. Christ saves the lost ones. So here there's grammatical change of subject. But then when we move back up here, who's the subject again? Now, we have joy, or we now have faith, or we trust. And obviously, who's the subject here? You know, the same us person. So five of the six, we are the subject of the action or of the sentence or of the predicates. But when you switch to gospel, there's a change the subject. But that change of subject makes us new subjects when we trust it. You know, when we're hooked into it, we are different people. And so this side then is sort of, what can you now predicate to the new subject, the new person after the Christ connection? Well, you predicate this in place of that. You predicate this as sort of the way of life out in public in place of that. When Paul talks about the scandal of the gospel, and most of you, I suppose, have heard that phrase, I've often wondered just what on earth does he really mean? And I had a teacher once who said, here's what he means, Ed. This change of subject is scandalous. Scandalous in the sense of, you know, offensive, even morally offensive. You know, it's not fair that while we're being diagnosed that, you know, we don't then take the consequences, or we don't then get our comeuppance. But this strange gospel says, tell you what, at the very deepest pit, God will do a sweet swap with you. And in Christ, he proposes to do that. He says, tell you what, I'll let him take the rap for you. Let him get, quote, lost on the cross so you can get found. I'll let him die so that you can live. I use the phrase, folksy phrase, sweet swap. My colleague Bob Bertram, who's worked with me in this crossings business for lo these many years, uses that as the sort of simple English translation of Luther's little phrase, fröhlicher Wechsel. He said, Luther says, what's going on the cross? A fröhlicher Wechsel. Fröhlich means jumping for joy, exchange, a swap. And so it's a very sweet swap that Jesus says, you got all these sins? Tell you what, dump them on me. And I got all this righteousness, I'll dump that on you. What I'm really quoting there is Paul in 2 Corinthians 5, who says a little more sophisticatedly, God was in Christ reconciling the world, God was in Christ reconciling the world. He made him to be sin for us. You know, our sin got tucked onto him so that we might get the righteousness of God that was in him. That was Luther's one place where Luther said, Paul's doing this sweet swap stuff. And then and Luther said, I think Paul got that from the fourth suffering servant poem in Isaiah. You know, he is wounded for our transgressions, he is bruised for our iniquities. With him getting striped, we get healed. You know, that sweet swap talk again. Okay, and that at the moral level is immoral. You know, we ought to take our own rap. We ought to take our own comeuppance. And we shouldn't get goodies if this is who we really are. You know, if the diagnosis is it, we ought to die. You know, that's fair and square. But the gospel at its deepest level is immoral on that count, in that it says someone else can take the death penalty and you can get life forever. And I have a hunch that that's why, well, something at least about that must have been in the scandal of the gospel phrase that Paul uses. And if there was anyone who would know that, it would be, you know, a super Pharisee like Paul was, who says, wait a minute, you get what you got coming, God says so. And now here's this Jesus guy, and he says, well, you can swap it with me if you want to, and you'll have a different future. You'll be a different subject, you know? You'll be a completely different life after that. All right, that's a little, well, it's getting longer, a little variation on, not variation, a little aspect of what you might say the pattern or the system or the structure. I've got another one that I know will interest Don, but we'll talk about that tomorrow or the next day, and that is how here and here we have imperatives again directed to us, but they're not law imperatives, they're grace imperatives. You know, now trust me and go into the world. So that these are grace imperatives that are the flow off of this, but that needs more conversation. Carl.
Do you have to go through these levels, or can God save us, you know, even if we're still at the first level, or even if we're not even experiencing darkness at all. I mean, it seemed to me that God can work God's will at any time. Or is there a sense in Luke that to really get the point of God's grace or God's existence in the world, that we really have to go deeply and let go or lose?
What do you think? You'd like the former, but you suspect
the latter. I'd like the path of least resistance.
I'd like
to get it quickly.
You're so human, so sinfully human. When we all like the quick fix.
But you know there's no such thing as a quick fix. You know, you've been telling us that over there. You said if we started right now fixing everything, maybe 10 or 20 years from now we'd notice the change. There ain't no quick fix.
Mm-hmm. But there is a sure fix in this one. At least the Christian gospel says there is a sure fix for any sinner, no matter how damned lost or you are, or whatever. But there is a sure fix. Maybe fix isn't it. There's a sure healing. There's a sure cure. There's sure health, no matter how damn sick you are.
If you just want to use the medical model, which we're sort of using here, Carl, I guess I would say, who is it that needs to know about the deep root? For example, if your diagnosis is cancer, doctor says, I know it, the radiologist knows it, who read the sheets, other people who've done tests know it, but who's the one who needs to know, you know, what the root is? You, because you're the one who needs the healing. Now, I don't know if that means that every time you read a biblical text, you got to always take people down to the pit. I know, that when this kind of diagnosis is being done on me by a biblical text, if I weren't already aware and in some sense living also over here, I couldn't even stand to go that deep or deeper or deeper. That it takes, you know, some of the good news resource even to say, well, okay, so I'm in darkness. Is it even worse than that? Can I even risk going deeper? And Jesus says, sure you can, because I've healed the deeper too. So step on down. Hey, Jesus, is it even worse than that? And he says, yeah, I think it is. You know, if I had to die, you must have been in bad shape. You know, what's the deadly thing about you? Jesus says, trust me, go down one more. I have a brother-in-law who taught out here in your West Coast, George Hoyer, Seminex, and was at PLTS, who as pastor once had this episode, at least he told us once in a chapel sermon. He said, I had a woman who had a very deadly sickness that couldn't be diagnosed, and she was really dying in the hospital. He was in Silver Springs, Maryland, suburban Washington, D.C. And he said, and then something either, I don't remember now, it was a new miracle drug that had just been passed by the, whatever that outfit is, drug and something. Yeah, USDA. Or the doctor had come up with some other drug they had administered, and she started mending and going up. Long recuperation. She finally comes back to church on a Sunday morning, healed, and she's shaking hands with the pastor, who had regularly visited her, of course, my brother-in-law, George. She says, Pastor, you know, I didn't know how sick I was until I got better. I couldn't go to the depths of where I was until I was already getting healed. I think that's an illustration, at least, of the same thing. Let's go to the text. Could you read it? Luke 12, 13 to 31.
One of the multitude said to him, Teacher, bid my brother divide the inheritance with me. But he said to him, Man, who made me a judge or divider over you? And he said to them, Take heed and beware of all covetousness, for a man's life does not consist in the abundance of his possessions. And he told them a parable, saying, The land of a rich man brought forth plentifully. And he thought to himself, What shall I do, for I have nowhere to store my crops? And he said, I will do this. I will pull down my barns and build larger ones, and there I will store all my grain and my goods. And I will say to my soul, Soul, you have ample goods laid up for many years. Take your ease, eat, drink, be merry.
Stop. Don, every time it says soul in that translation, the Greek word is psyche, for psychology and psychiatry. Since I've interrupted, what do other translations have for where it here says soul?
Lucky man.
Come on.
That's right.
Huh?
Yeah. Which version? Then what? I will say to myself, lucky man.
No.
Yeah, mindset.
Self is what it's. Self is the translation of the word CK. And that lucky man is what he says. Because this guy says to his soul, hey, I made it. Come on, you know Greek better than that.
Self.
Has anyone got any others?
Soul.
Somebody this morning in the first version had a translation that said life. And that is one possibility. I think psyche is a dicey word to translate, but and especially in our Western Plato-influenced culture, where we are inclined to think that human beings are made of body and soul, and that those are sort of two at least distinguishable parts, even if you could separate them out. Whereas biblical, at least Hebrew, what folks around here call First Testament anthropology, always says human beings are whole entities. And if you talk about any one part of them, you know, like the human heart, then that's pars pro toto. That's talking about a part, but it really means the whole human being. In this sense, when you talk about in your heart, you did this or that, that means at the center of your person, you know, where all stuff sort of comes in and registers and from which then you live your life out. Okay, so the guy says, soul, psyche, take it easy, lucky guy. Here's what you got.
But God said to him, fool, this night your soul is required of you, and the things you have prepared, whose will they be?
Now, if it said lucky guy in your text, Don, what does it say then for fool?
Unlucky guy.
You fool.
Yeah. dummy.
Okay.
Okay, but now where she said this very night your soul is being demanded, mine says life.
Okay, that's where the word life comes in. In our very personalist culture nowadays, I think maybe even just the word person would be a tolerable translation. You know, you're a very person. And the word self is close to that, you know. The totality of who you are, and specifically sort of who you are in your own uniqueness. You know, you're a different person from any other person. But the you who you are, whoosh, that's psyche. Okay?
Let's see. And the things you have prepared, whose will they be? So is he who lays up treasure for himself and is not rich toward God. And he said to his disciples, therefore I tell you, do not be anxious about your life, what you shall eat, nor about your body, what you shall put on. For life is more than food, and the body more than clothing. Consider the ravens, they neither sow nor reap, they have neither storehouse nor barn, and yet God feeds them. Of how much more value are you than the birds? And which of you, by being anxious, can add a cubit to his span of life?
Anybody got any alternates for cubit?
Single hour.
Single hour. Did anybody remember?
A bit longer. Isn't
it? A bit longer. Okay, you know, it's just another segment. It's not really a specific measurement, I think. And single hour is also kind of metaphorical. Do you remember? How many of you are old enough to remember Bill Cosby's early routine about Noah?
Yeah.
And God tells him to build this ark. And, you know, it's an incredible, you know, a classic Cosby.
Beautiful.
And God gives you instruction about, you know, so many cubits this way, so many cubits that way.
What's a cubit?
What's a cubit? And God said, I used to know that. Well, and then he says, do this bitumen and tar it and whatever. Okay, cubit is used here, sort of another piece, another segment, regardless of what its length is.
My translation says crows instead of ravens. And I mean, ravens is much better because ravens are much more important in the biblical world.
And you used it yesterday in your description, in the your contribution you made over here to that discussion.
Yeah, right.
He once talked about, well, say it briefly in a couple sentences. What happened to you with the raven?
Oh, I told some stories about raven to a native person whose clan is the raven, and she, although was a Christian, never had seen the word raven in the Bible, and all of a sudden, some new things started to unpack for her, because, like in this passage, everybody thinks, look at the birds, and they never see that there is a specific bird mentioned, and of course, the raven is of particular interest to West Coast Native people. And the raven is particularly interest in terms of biblical stories as well.
Elijah. But then what happened?
You preached. Remember your story about your preaching?
Yeah.
Come on. Right. Give us the kicker at the end.
All right. So I prepared a sermon. in which I told all the stories of Raven, or some of the stories of Raven that were in the Bible. She was sitting there, and I pointed and said, "Look at the raven." I pointed out the window, and on the ledge, a raven. No, it was. I think it was a crow, but we thought it was a raven. A raven came and sat on the ledge and was just right there. So we sort of said, I have a particular relationship to ravens.
Yeah, that must be.
When they say crows, I say, give us a break.
I want a real black bird, yeah. Okay, even the ravens, and we're much more valued, says Jesus, than ravens. And they are valuable because God cares for them. Okay, press on.
If then you are not able to do as small a thing as that, why are you anxious about the rest? Consider the lilies, how they grow. They neither toil nor spin. And I tell you, even Solomon in all his glory was not arrayed like one of these. But if God so clothes the grass, which is alive in the field today, and tomorrow is thrown into the oven, how much more will he clothe you, O men of little faith? And do not seek what you are to eat and what you are to drink, nor be of anxious mind. For all the nations of the world seek these things, and your Father knows that you need them. Instead, seek his kingdom, and these things shall be yours as well.
Okay, I have the answer sheet here. Marie and I worked it out yesterday and put it on the computer, filled in the boxes, and I'm going to hand it out in a minute. Since yesterday we sort of filled the boxes by group conversation, and pedagogically that is much better, but we didn't get done. And that's not necessarily bad, but when you don't get done and only get here and never get over here, then it is bad. You know, then you never get to the good news to help us with the bad news. And I'm biting my tongue not to ask Don that since you opted to live the life of a bum, which I gather means, you know, no very explicit possessions, has that freed you from anxiety and worry? And I have a hunch it has not.
I'm still a first-class worrier.
Okay.
But it did actually help.
Okay.
Because I was at even worse.
That's hard to imagine. Oh, wow, okay. First of all, connective thread. Is there any string that holds these several beads together in this particular text? The first one is this one brother says, "Hey, Jesus, you know, there's property inheritance here, and I'm not getting a fair shake from my brother." Next one is then the parable of the rich, the farmer who had bumper crop and boom harvest. And then the next is sort of Jesus' sermon to his disciples about personal worry, anxiety, and concern. You know, not about bumper crops, but just about basics.
The last word on your top line, anxiety, is in all of them. That's one.
Okay, wait, yeah, I put a few more words up there. It's about possessions, it's about abundance, it's about worry, anxiety. Now, I'm still asking you, is there some common thread about those three or those four nouns that you would say a thesis, a sentence you could make about holding that all together, or that touches on you? A sentence, or technically the word thesis, you know, an assertion.
No matter what, we always worry about stuff.
Okay, if you wanted to make an assertion that looks like diagnostic x-ray, no matter what, everybody's worried about stuff. Even Jesus' disciples here, and that means most likely the disciples here. Always worried about stuff, no matter if you got beaucoup, lots of it, or little.
And I find that people have, the more you have, the more you worry about it.
Now notice you said people. That means not this guy.
Well, I was thinking of parishioners.
Well, are you satisfied that might be sort of a sentence that was sort of pick up a lot of what we'd call the diagnostics here? No matter how much people have, disciples as well, people are chronic, always worriers, always anxious about the stuff.
I think there's another thread too, and that's about life. Life keeps, I mean, it's the fear of losing your life if you don't have the things.
Okay, so that our life depends on things, huh?
Yeah. My anxiety about stuff is not getting more. My anxiety about is reducing the amount that I have, but making sure I keep the right stuff.
Yeah.
I mean, the truly useful or whatever.
Yeah. Do you still have insurance?
Yes.
Sorry about that. You still blew it. We all, at least I do. Do you have insurance?
A friend of my family's to solve a family problem paid for my medical insurance.
Okay, so you do too, but with somebody else being the one. Well, okay, let's say if that's a diagnostic common thread,
We think that life consists of possessions, and therefore, no matter how much we got, we're worried about it. Is there a good news thread that you might pull through, or that Jesus himself is pulling through all of these little pieces in the very face of that diagnostic?
Well, is don't worry about it. That seems to come across.
Okay, don't worry about it would be sort of the behavioral conclusion.
Yeah, don't worry about stuff.
What about, okay, but you can't, let me ask you, has that ever worked for you? When you were worried shitless about something, you said, look, man, don't worry about it. It doesn't work because that worry's got a deeper root. Now, you may not want to go like Carl said, all the way down to the pit all the time, but unless you get deeper, just telling somebody don't worry about it is just putting a Band-Aid on, and you know, you rip it off right away because you say that's no help. Because worry has root, and maybe even that root of worry has even a deeper root. At least that's what this sort of triad here suggests. Here's the behavioral stuff, and obviously we're going to put worry about possessions and abundance in here. That's got a root, and well, there might even be a deeper root under that.
I forget your name, but she touched on the deep root, and that is survival. That is saving your life.
Ooh, saving, hey. Who claims that as his turf and his alone? This one, you know, this strange Jesus, or God and his beloved son. Okay, that's still negative stuff. That's still diagnostics. Well, what's the good news? Is there a good news theme?
That we are of value.
We are of value
to God.
Can you get the word possessions in that sentence somehow? Because since possessions are, you know, stuff.
God will give you what you need to possess.
Okay, with reference to stuff, God is the giveaway God, and he says, whatever stuff you need, I give you. And you have value apart from stuff. Mm-hmm. Because God says, you're worthier than the big blackbird, and you're worthy, period. Well, you're worthy apart from stuff, which probably, it just sort of flip that over, that says, we think our worth consists in stuff. And our culture sure does. Maybe every culture always has. You know, if people didn't have material stuff, then they had prestige stuff, talent stuff, or you had genetic stuff. You were born of the king and the queen. And so you had it in your gene, you know.
Power
you
were stuff.
Huh?
Power
stuff. Stuff, stuff, stuff. Lots of stuff.
And what about children?
Children's stuff?
Children as the stuff that tells you that you're worth something.
Children as the value objects that then we say, that's where my value, I get a lot from it.
Thinking about biblical times.
Oh, I'm thinking about present times. Are Marie and I ever proud of our three kids who, much to our surprise, are still all churchy? You know, which is very unusual. And we say, God, how'd that happen? You know, because many of my preacher, seminary professor colleagues, you know, their kids are all over the map. You know, some are, some aren't. And our kids all got a college education, and our kids all got jobs, now still, you know. And boy, oh boy, and our baby got a PhD, you know. The stuff can be not just, you know, items that you can put on the ledger page. But what's the good news about all that? I mean, what's the alternate good news? Other than just don't hang on to stuff, don't be worried, you know. Those are all negatives saying, you know, get out of this side of the chart. But what's the, what are affirmatives that might hold all this, that do hold all or some of that together?
That you can transcend those earthly pleasures.
You can transcend them? Okay. Other?
With help.
No, that's good. I'm just fishing for other.
Lori was saying it. And God gives us what we need.
Okay, I've got. No. You don't have to guess.
Well,
I'm going to capitalize on what Don said. And related to what you said, you can transcend all that. Who is it? What's the subject in that sentence?
It's still I or we.
Right. And that. But he had a different subject. Don had a different subject in his sentence. What'd you say?
We're talking theory.
No. I want you to quote what
God
you said.
God will give us what we need.
No, that's not theory. That's just, you know, flat on the table. You had a sentence where I, me, we were still the subject of the sentence. We can transcend that. You can transcend that. And Don said, God gives you everything you need. What's the difference between those two sentences? Other than that, they got two different subjects.
Yeah, if I practiced that and believe, I'd be a happier person. I mean, I'm saying that this is what I believe, but it's not easy always to really live that way.
I think the difference is we can save ourselves versus we are saved by God. In other words, if we can transcend this, that means we have control, we can kind of somehow psych ourselves into a state of transcendence. He's saying, no, I think the passage is saying,
no way, Jose.
Yeah.
And just to put that on the chart, not that it's got to be on the chart, but your proposal, and many of us have say, I, we, me, us are the subject in this box for the fixer, the rescuer. I could be different, or someone could help me do a different thing, or just change my attitude. If I had a good shrink, a good psychologist or a psychiatrist who could get me to change those attitudes, I wouldn't need this Jesus figure in any sense. You know, I could be my own rescuer. And most of the therapeutic world we live in operates that way. That, you know, the therapeutic world says we know that the diagnosis has got to go deeper than just behaviors, because underlying behaviors are always attitudes or, you know, something internally. So the shrinks say we can help you change those, and they can. But if that's, and you know, we can move right over to here, and with new attitudes and heart, you can go back up there and you can really live a different life. That's true. The biblical perspective says you got to push the diagnosis one step deeper. And that's got to be fixed. Otherwise, all of this is in some sense still just Band-Aids. It may be very good Band-Aids, very long-lasting Band-Aids. But if you haven't changed a person's, if you will, God relationship, if that's defective, and for all human beings it is, then you sure helped, but you haven't given all the help you could have given if you could have gotten to, you know, the bottom x-ray. And then you'd have to, you know, name the name in some sense of who the rescuer really is, from which then comes new attitudes, new internalities, and then new externalities. At least that's the Bible paradigm.
Well, the
Don.
Well, in the story of the man with the abundance, it seems to me that it's a story of our generation, because Jesus calls the man with abundance fool, eh?
Right.
And it seems to me that the fool always in the
want a sheet up there?
In the first tradition, is the one who says there is no God.
Yeah.
And so here is a person who is living pretty much like a 20th century person, without any recognition whatsoever of that God is present or a part of his life, and therefore.
Yeah, be more specific. What's this guy not aware of, or not acknowledging at all, or not even thinking of about God and his own life, what we know about his life?
God has power over his life.
No. I mean, that's true, but that's this text isn't saying that. What is this text saying about the guy in the bumper harvest? Who gave him the bumper harvest?
God.
He's got no God connection in his mind or heart about the possessions he's got. You know, soul, take thy rest, or lucky boy, you have, you know, hit the jackpot. You have made it big. You finally farmed right this year, and to be sure the weather helped, you know.
Yeah, that's right, exactly.
Don?
This Barbara Walden interviewing the son of J. Paul Getty, and she says, well, wouldn't you just like to give your money away to the poor? And he says, well, no, I can't play God. You know, how would I decide how to give the money away? It's kind of a switch of looking at it. You know, he's going to not play. And Barbara Walters, after the show, was talking with Hugh Downs, and she says, if I had all that money, I'd sure give it away. And, you know, how much does Barbara Walters make? So,
oh, everybody, you know, only a couple hundred thousand every year, but, you know, that's not like Getty.
Right. And so everyone's looking at the person above them, each one feeling they're entitled, they have earned, they deserve.
Yeah, great. But in what respect was Getty correct with that one line you just quoted?
Well, he couldn't play God.
He couldn't save the world either.
Yeah, well, no, but in terms about what this text is talking about, with reference to God and possessions, the real giver away of stuff is God. Yeah. And he, in a subtle way or in an inverse way, acknowledged that. God, in order to give things away, I'd have to be God. Now, I expect he meant I'd have to be God to know who to give it to and who deserved it. But still, at least he's making a subtle connection. And if you were preaching the gospel to him or going to try, that might be a point of departure for engaging in conversation.
But he doesn't acknowledge that that money was a gift.
I know. Oh, I'm not saying anywhere he's not close to the kingdom as far as that sentence said. He's probably a baptized Christian, probably a Baptist. Now, if he becomes some the disciplined brethren, well, he might be in better shape.
That's right. We all live simply and give it all away.
Oh, thank God.
It's interesting that in making the choice about how to invest your money, to invest in people is sort of playing God, and we refrain from doing that. But to invest in a corporation, which is another sort of sphere of human activity, which eventually makes its way to people and employees, that's not playing God. So it's kind of curious how we select what is an appropriate manner for disposition of our wealth. It's fairly arbitrary, actually.
Just for fun, would you please just roll through these in the next 2 or 3 minutes, and let's just read them out loud. As I said, Marie and I brainstormed this yesterday evening and pumped it into the computer, and let's see how this relates to what you yourself have seen. That's putting this today's text into the Luke paradigm. Would you, Carl, just give us the first one, and then next, we got six of us, so just six of you do the six pieces.
Signals of darkness, squabble about inheritance, all kinds of greed.
The numbers are verse references to the text.
The folly of equating life with abundance of possessions.
The farmer.
Striving for things as Gentiles do.
I don't know if you noticed that in that last paragraph, what Jesus says, don't worry about what you're going to eat, what you're going to drink. He says Gentiles do that, which is him saying, or the nations do that. Nations is the goyim, the unchosen people, the ones who aren't in the God fellowship. And so just at the behavioral level, Jesus is saying, isn't that kind of dumb? At least if you're a Christ person, a Christ woman, why would you want to be like the non-Christ people? But, that's just surface diagnosis. Important, but that's still not saying, what's underneath all that. So let's press deeper.
In fear, missed focus, fear, worry.
Four references to worry or anxiety.
No faith that your Father knows you need them.
The word fear doesn't pop up here as a term. Is fear in the mixed in this text, even though the word isn't?
Sure.
Where?
In worry. When you worry, you're afraid of something. That's how I see it.
Yeah. I put on the board for today fear as negative faith. That as it's a form of faith, but it's not a faith in some good plus object, but it's faith in a negative object. Maybe the trust that X, whatever it is, or X and a skull and a crossbones, is a threat to my life, and that if I don't do something, it'll get me. Whether it's the mushroom-shaped cloud or what the Dow did yesterday in terms of my portfolio. And so fear is, in this sense, trust, but trust in something threatening. And that's why Luther said, I use those three verbs in the catechism. We should fear, love, and trust in God. We should fear, love, and trust in God, because those are three verbs of the heart. And fear is just sort of a flip form, an invert form, maybe a perverted form of trust and love. Okay, Don, the deep six.
Lust, not rich toward God, 21. God says, you fool, this night your life is demanded and you lose everything, verse 20. And the oven, whatever that is, verse 28.
Well, you probably didn't catch it. Well, what is verse 28 about the oven?
The grass.
Jesus compares he says, think of the grass analogy. And that is not a pleasant analogy. I mean, he says, it's there one day and zap, it's gone and it's used for fuel. Now, it's kind of macabre nowadays to talk about the oven with Auschwitz and that whole history as part of our history. But, if you want a grim one that Jesus himself uses as to, how lost you could be, that's a biblical reference, or a biblical image. Old Testament has image, fire. and God as blazing fire and all that. And well, that's in the New Testament too. But these are Luke's words here for lostness. And with reference to that that rich farmer, it's really total loss. He not only loses his stuff, but he loses his life. You could almost say almost automatically, because if you invest your life in the stuff, when the stuff is gone, you are gone.
And when you're gone, the stuff doesn't matter.
Yeah, and in this case, it's when you're gone, the stuff that said Ed Schrader's stuff suddenly becomes Nathan Schrader's stuff, Anne-Marie Schrader Bogdan's stuff. You know, it ain't mine at all. So that's already a clear teaser by Jesus to, you know, think about how fragile the possession link is. I mean, the ownership link is between you and the stuff. And interesting enough, death always severs it whether you had a will or not. So at least think about it. Don? Don first.
It's just a lie. It may not be true, but I sometimes like to think in the last days there's a purifying fire that's going to, when it destroys the world, those that are attached to the world are going to have their affections burned out of them. But that's not a theology that you'll find anywhere.
Well, is it or isn't it? Will there be? But the thing is, Don, will there be anything left of this person who had such affections?
If your affections are tied to the world, there's probably still something left, but it's sure going to feel like you've died.
Okay.
You know, like if you've ever had known somebody, like my sister, it was when her house burned down, she said, I was ashamed at how I responded, how crazy I was. It's only a house. As it turns out, she got her insurance to repay it, but she was so identified with that thing.
That she thought her life, or at least a big chunk of her life, was going up in smoke.
Mm-hmm.
Like burn, baby, burn.
Actually, go along with that, phrasing that more positively, right out of verse 23, is that life is more than food and the body more than clothing. I mean, that's a positive way of saying that, but that's the joy.
Right. And that's a clear a contrast to what the farmer represents. He thinks his person is determined by the stuff he's got, by, you know, what he wears, what he drinks, how long a vacation he takes, you know, how big the solid gold Cadillac is, or, you know, or whatever. And Jesus does the exact flipperoo, which is, you know, which we got to put over here, tuck in on this side, that the new perspective when one is connected to this Jesus finder savior is, well, it's the antithesis of the whole, everything that's on this side. Well, why don't you pick up and start us at the bottom, the good news at the deep root, and then we'll just come on up.
In Jesus' other job, not judge or arbitrator, but finder, savior.
You know, I wonder, since you and I have an unfinished dialogue about law and gospel going, if Luke might want us to be saying the inheritance squabbler, or the wants Jesus to be a legal arbiter. And whatever else Jesus says, he says, sorry, that's not my job. I got a different job, you know, and Luke's language for what the different job is, you know, these job descriptors.
He is the Father's good pleasure giving us the kingdom.
Now, if you pay attention to the text, you notice I cheated. I went to verse 32 to get that. That's the first verse of the text we're going to study next time. But it's too good not to tuck in here that the whole business of kingdom, whom Jesus, in a sense, is or is bringing, is all gift, which is, of course, clean contrary to achievement, worth, or even just, you know, I got it because of, you know, because my parents were rich and therefore I got it, or because I worked hard, or because I was smart, or because, but all those becauses are point to this subject and what he, she has done. And the change of subject here is, with reference to possession, remember, God's the gift giver. But as long as we're talking about that, let's take a look at the big gift. You know, the big gift that fixes up the cancerous deep root, where God gives us the kingdom in what he gives us in the crucified and risen Messiah. And it's a Father's good pleasure. Now, that's a real contrast to what God says to this rich farmer. He doesn't say, gee, you know, I like you so much, I think tonight I'll just take your life away from you. You know, that's judgment. That's, you know, that's this guy's oven. All right, so the good news about Jesus is, in this case is, if you will, God's changes the subject. and we become the beneficiaries of that switch in subjects. And then we become new subjects, and look what all now can be said about us. Don?
Let me read
we're coming up the chart. Yeah, it's number five if you count in this perverse horseshoe way.
Joy, rejoice, not worrying, trusting the gift kingdom of Jesus.
Now, there's no word joy or rejoice in this text, you know, in these 18 verses or whatever it is. Can you, in some sense, pull those together, or do we say here Luke is sort of deserting the joy motif and moving up to something else? Don, if you could totally kick the worry wart that's still in you, mm-hmm. would the word J-O-Y apply?
Yes.
Can you spec that out a little, or at least just give us a sentence on how for you that would really be, whew, hallelujah?
Well, it'd be to just give up on my responsibility to have to solve everything, I suppose.
And what you're doing right now, smiling, you could do a lot more.
I did, yeah.
Instead of these long face that you often, at least in the 4 days I've been here.
Oh, actually, I'm happier now than I usually am.
Oh, my God, why did you look like that? Well, hallelujah, you know, thank God. Well, look at that one. We got to photograph that one. Oh, that's beautiful. You know, that is joy. Great. Okay, up to the top on the right side.
Glory and glorify. Receiving everything as gift from God. Not our possessions, not being had by what we have.
Okay, that bracket is my addendum. But, you know, if you think things are gift from God, and then someone asks you, well, whose are they really? Well, then, you know, you say, well, they're not mine. But, you know, they're God's. But for the moment, they're in my hands. But as far as ownership goes, you know, that's really the owner. And I'm the processor or the steward or the servant who's managing. But then how do you manage? You would at least manage differently from the examples we had over here. And as the next paragraph says after this bracket, well, let's look at the bracket I put in there. Not being had by what we have. I was trying to be funny, you know, but our meeting didn't get over till after 11 o'clock last night, and so I came home punchy to punch this stuff in. But the whole, you can pun on possession. You know, who owns whom? When, well, just in this rich farmer's case. If owner means the one in charge who sort of manages the show, this guy's barns and silos and bumper crops are managing his life. He shapes his life in terms of what the possessions call for. It's not the other way around. So you could say the stuff owns him and not him the stuff. And that's, I'm sure, not too far from the truth about a big slice of each one of us here, not just them out there. Flo was in here the first session. What's her last name? Florence Pendergrast. Is that it? Mm-hmm. And after class, she said, Ed, there was something funny. I said, somebody told the story, she said last week, maybe it was Walt Bowman, that I guess a whole night went out of the village and in some parking lot, couldn't have been Fields Point, there wouldn't have been anything like that, was, you know, the equivalent of a solid gold Cadillac with all the bells and whistles. And this whole night was admired, or just looking at, I suppose, admiring it. Let's hope I wasn't lusting. Probably was. And the guy, a guy, the owner comes up and says, how do you like that? The guy says, fine. He says, no nigger has a Cadillac like that one. And
did I hear what I thought?
You heard what you thought. That's what the quote was. And the whole night said, wait a minute, I want to get my camera. And he goes and gets the camera and says, why do I take a picture? I want a picture of you and the Cadillac. Because I've never had a clear picture of someone who is going straight to hell. that's at least in keeping with, you know, to be sure, the whole night might have been overinterpreting. But on the basis of the available data, that sounded like this guy, right? And, you know, he's a lost one, even though he's got this, you know, $50,000 kit. Okay, not being had by what we have, and now would you please continue?
Continuing God's own giveaway program, no striving for things at all. Paul, having as though we had not.
Okay, that next bracket is a Pauline corollary where Paul, several times Paul has this little, it's almost like a little liturgy where he talks about himself and encourages, I think these are all in Corinthians, encourages the Corinthian Christians to do the same. To be sure we have stuff. But if you see them as gift from God, then you have them as though you don't really have them. You know, they're not really yours to have, but they're yours, Augustine said, they're yours to use, but not to hang your heart on. He distinguished between two Latin words, frui and uti. Frui means to trust it, to hang on to it, you know, to make it your the object of faith. Uti means, from which you get the word utility and utility, you know, just to use it. And then to give it away, to give it away. If God himself in Christ is the big giveaway program, and we are God's connected agents, servants, kids, then you know what's the job assignment? Keep the giveaway program going. And what you got is mine, says God, for you to use and then for you to give away. Give away, give away. And that's the opening verse in the next text we're going to look at. After we got all these things from God, therefore, sell what you have, give it away, blah, 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 blah. Question, how could you make a pitch for this just in your own personal life and make it work? Or at least, you know, at least move in that direction. And the second one is, you know, how, if at all, could we get our whole culture and society, you know, give witness that would push that way?
I'm thinking of the passage that says, the commandment that says, worship God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength. And mind is an important part of that. And what to me that commandment says, don't have a faith that calls upon you to subvert your mind.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so now we know in the modern world what science can do for us. And we know in the modern world what money can do for us. And in fact, if you've got money, you can add an hour to your life. If you've got good life insurance, you've got access to a good hospital, you can have your life prolonged.
Sure.
In fact, you can commit a double murder and hire good lawyers and probably get off the hook.
Well,
you
you're
can,
trying to be relevant, hey? Yeah.
So
okay.
I'm saying you got money and you can add
okay.
an hour to your life. And I'm just wondering, you know, how now that we've got this world and this knowledge in a system that is so money-centered, can this gospel of letting go work for us?
I have an answer to that.
Here we go.
Life
great.
Is more than food and clothing. I mean, that's, I don't think it's literally just, we may want to focus on prolonging our life an hour or longer, but what good is that if your life is
right. Life is more than life is more than food and clothing, but if you've got the food and clothing, the more food and clothing, the more. I mean, why not? Why not have the food and clothing and all the others?
Because what goes along with that is all the worry and the anxiety. I mean,
yeah.
I think that's where the lostness is.
Your reference to the Simpson case, I think, is also an illustration of what she's saying, and that bunch of people doesn't have a lot of life in it. I mean, there's so much emptiness in all of that.
Yeah, at least I think these texts we're looking at from Luke would say, you know, O.J.'s life will doubtless be extended, you know, he'll escape the rap, and his money will have engineered that. But the Bible would say, O.J., you and your lawyers, you're in the dark. You guys think your life, you think human life consists of how much you can do, even how what control you have to extend it. That's bullshit. That just ain't true. And you guys are already lost. You know, you may not be burning right now, but you guys are lost. Your deep three is true about you right now. Now, I may not be able to convince you of that, but if you had, you know, a quiet, sober moment, I'd like to at least, you know, take you down the path once. Not just to, you know, get you to come to church or to prove that you're wrong, but to get you to real life because you guys got a phony life. Even though our American culture says, man, that's living!
Yeah, I mean, on either side of the courtroom, it's that way.
Sure, oh yeah, the prosecution and the defense, I guess.
And a lot of the witnesses, I mean, it's just, there's a so, it's so whole thing is so sad. So sorry.
Has anyone, you know, I've been out of the country for over a year and a half, so I've been out of the loop. Has anyone done serious or even unserious theological analysis of this phenomenon in our public life right now? You know, the sort of stuff that Carl's just kicked us off on?
I haven't seen
it. You know, just to say, you know, what's the theology of the OJ trial? And most of us would say, well, it sure ain't gospel. Well, then, what is it, and how would we at least lay gospel alongside so that folks could see the difference? Even if they wouldn't go for our gospel, they could at least see the difference.